Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview was an utter delight to do. Kathy Eldon, you are going to absolutely have to spend time listening to this interview. It's really not that long, and it's going to fly by for you. Kathy and I touch on a little bit of everything. She's wonderful. She's delightful. She's got so much passion and energy and a real commitment to turning the world upside down, and has a history to prove it. She's got the evidence, and some of it's empirical, but most of it's all based and rooted in relationship and story, and that is just what makes her so ridiculously compelling to listen to. So have I said enough? She's got a book, her memoir, In the Heart of a Life. She has many books. She's involved in a film that's soon to be released, The Journey is the Destination, about her son, who was a journalist, the youngest Reuters journalist at 22, who was, well, I'm going to let you find out more about it. She's involved with an organization called creativevisions.org. In fact, a founder and still very much involved there. You're gonna hear about compassion. You're going to hear about being fearless and about global tribes and about what it means to actually make a difference in the world and about creative activism and why Kathy believes that life really does begin beyond our comfort zones. What a delight. I'm already looking forward to part two. Kathy Eldon is coming up. And for more information about podcasts and my speaking and my writing, davidpecklive.com, rabble.ca. Stay tuned. Buckle up. Kathy Eldon coming your way.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by another very special guest here today, Kathy Eldon, who I kind of met, but from a distance. Kathy, we never shook hands, but I'm hoping we made eye contact when you were sitting on
that really good-looking guy in the fourth row back left. Seat 12B.
That's where I
was
sitting.
That was me.
Yeah. So, Kathy, thanks for joining us today. It's a real privilege to have you on the show. So Kathy Eldon, I mean, where do we begin for crying out loud? KathyEldon.com, we've got Creative Visions, we've got your son's work, we've got the books you've written, you've got a TEDx talk coming up. Oh, and a film, I think, that's coming out soon that you might want to talk about.
Absolutely. We might want to just casually buy it. Absolutely.
where do we begin with Kathy Eldon? This is the question.
When you say it like that, all I see is what I haven't done.
Wow.
I'm fixated, focused eternally on the prospect of so much more ahead and so much to do in this ridiculously challenging world. Mm. Divisive, hateful rhetoric and nonsense at a time when if we can pull together, we really can do extraordinary things and create the world of our choice instead of something that seems to be fragmenting and in front of our very eyes.
So it sounds to me, though, you don't carry that. You know, when you see all that I see is what I haven't done, you know, I think I share that to some degree, but you don't seem to carry that as a burden, or do you?
Well, that's a beautiful question. I think for the past 23 years, it was a real burden because I had two objectives. One was to write a book which would share the story of my life, which not because I'm narcissistic. I mean, we're all probably egocentric at some level, but I really thought that there were things that I'd seen or done that maybe not everybody's had an opportunity to,
sure.
that might be of use to others. So I had to write that book, and it took me 16 years.
Wow.
And then the other absolute determined, you know, something I had to do, and it was a burden, was to make a film about Dan and my son and his friends and colleagues, and I just had to do that.
Mm.
So for 23 years, burden, now it's privilege, I think.
Right.
The things that I get to do are more of a privilege.
Well, and speaking of privilege, you guys were celebrated at the Toronto International Film Festival just recently. The film and maybe you should talk about a little bit about the film, Kathy, but I definitely want to hear more about you and why. I think capital W, why. But The Journey is the Destination, directed by Bronwyn Hughes, and from what I understand was received pretty well.
Oh, it was really wonderful. We had the great honor of being given the Roy Thomson Hall, which is I believe the largest screen in Canada. It's really a concert hall that seats about nearly 2,000 people. And I'm told that they choose films that they think will really resonate with the audiences for that enormous venue.
Nice.
And we were so excited because I think there were about 1,000 films entered into the festival. Maybe 300 were accepted, and just a tiny little, maybe 17, 18, were actually chosen for gala premieres. And we got the, 6:30 at night in the biggest hall.
I know, that's wonderful. Yeah.
So, were you at that?
I wasn't. I'm so sorry I wasn't there. No, and I have to say, just it was a real a feat of juggling and planning and scheduling this year for me. I had about 30 different interviews. It was, I will get out to see the film when. Oh yeah, speaking of that, let's get a plug in. Wide theater release is coming, but not quite there. Is that right?
No, and this is an independent film.
Right.
It took us many years to really get it going, and it had a studio start, which is when we attached a phenomenal scriptwriter, Jan Sardi, who had just come off of Shine, where he was nominated for an Oscar. We Lisa Henson, who was then president of Columbia Studios, attached Bronwyn Hughes, who was just off Forces of Nature. And these are two extraordinary people. And they, I had the great privilege of working with Jan for about 3 or 4 years early on as he was writing the script and crafting it. And he would call, I would call him almost every day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon my time, because it was then Australian time. He had just wakened up, and he would tell me his latest sort of dream world of dreaming new scenes and characters, and he just always felt that Dan was in that dream world with him. And for those in the audience, who most of you who don't know, my son Dan was a young artist, a real explorer, but also a Reuters photojournalist who was killed at the age of 22 while he was covering a story in Somalia. And he was killed together with 3 other young journalists. It was a terrible mistake, and the people felt really badly after they'd killed them all. But Dan was no longer, in a physical presence when Jan was having these conversations with him.
So all I see is what I haven't done. I mean, it seems to me, from what little I know of you, and I can hear the passion in your voice now, and I know my listeners can too, and I could see it at that TIFF on the panel discussion and so on. I mean, a lot of people would just sort of say, you know what, I'm going to celebrate what I have done. But you still have so many more seeds to plant.
And seeds is a good word. And I use the word spark.
Mm.
I love seeds. What I do is I have the honor, the privilege of working with other people who are trying to create projects and productions that will push people to action, incite them to action, catalyze some form of action. We call these people creative activists. And it's a term we coined many years ago to describe that creative spark that exists within each one of us that I always think could be used not only for yourself but also for others. And in 1998, we launched a foundation called Creative Visions, which was the name of my production company, which we'd started in 1990 to make a film about ivory poaching. But Creative Visions exists to support creative activism worldwide. And it's really been fun because we've worked with more than 260 individuals.
Mm, that's amazing.
We have projects and productions that art, music, dance, drama, film, that deal with social, humanitarian, and environmental issues, but in a really sort of storytelling fashion. You know, everything's about the story.
Right.
And what's the story? So they tell stories that need to be told about problems that need to be solved, and then attach people to those issues and give them something to do. You can't, in other words, if you're going to be part of our operation, you can't just inform, you can't just inspire, you have to get out there and empower people to do something.
You got to get people moving.
Off their backsides.
And how, you know, okay, so I believe me, I'm not looking for the one answer, and I really rail against polarization and debate and conversation, and when it comes to political issues and so on. I mean, relationships, how can it be either or, right? It's nuanced, it's subtle. But how the heck do you get people off their backsides? Is it cumulative over time, Kathy? Do you think so?
I love that you said that. I started off in 1988. I was a journalist in Kenya, and I was the only journalist allowed on the set of Out of Africa.
Wow.
And
okay.
Yeah, it was really amazing. Actually,
that's pretty cool.
Very funny and sweet story. But
I bet you got some goodies. Yeah.
I got to. Oh man, if you haven't read my book, In the Heart of Life,
I have not.
It's a juicy read. I don't know. You may be too young.
That's funny.
I was privileged to be. Again, I keep using that word, but I was really
good.
Lucky.
Love it.
That Sydney. Well, thank you. Sydney Pollack had read an article that I read on the woman who wrote West with a Night, Beryl Markham, and so he asked if he could go meet Beryl. And at that point, Beryl was 85 and existed on a diet of mostly nothing except gin and tonics. So it was orange.
I'm pretty sure I've done that diet actually at one point.
You know, she looked great, man. Did she have so cheekbones, everything? She'd had unbelievable life and had been the first person to fly from west to east. So I took him, but urging him to bring along a bottle of gin if she really wanted to have the proper story. Maybe it was vodka, I can't remember. But we had a wonderful visit with Beryl, and then he very kindly invited me to be able to go on set because it was really like a military operation.
Great.
But, you know, with that exposure, I just realized that journalism was one thing, and it was great, and I loved it. But, you know, the newspaper sold maybe 200,000 copies, and then maybe a million people saw it because it was passed around. But with a film, we could really touch a lot of people.
Sure.
And I thought, wow, you know, if you could do films that had some sort of message in them, certainly entertain, but that had a message, we could shift consciousness around issues. Mm. And so in 1990, we set up this Creative Visions, and the first film was called Lost in Africa, and it was about ivory poaching. Mm. And, you know, and following that, then other things happened, but I started being going into the documentary world, I realized that really you could make an impact, but you can't measure it.
Right.
And that ultimately, over time, you could shift people's beliefs about things or ideas or concepts. But it's really hard to measure. But me, as the age that I am and the perspective I have, I can see that people are shifting.
Right.
And Al Gore, you know, when he did An Inconvenient Youth, he shifted people's thoughts, and it didn't happen, and he didn't get elected, and please, I wish he had, because we would be way further along in climate change countering it. But he made people think.
Yes.
And so many of the films that I've had the great pleasure of being around, you know, and were an umbrella for many, many extraordinary films, and people are waking up. The film on rape, you know, The Hunting Game, that really woke up people around rape on college campuses. People are doing things about it, and I think it awakened them around sexual assault, and that's part of the response right now that people are having right after seeing the tapes that are, you know, sort of blatantly claiming the right to sexually assault other people. So, yeah, I think we can wake people up.
So what,
It may take time.
What's fascinating to me is you've got. I mean, you know, it's interesting. You know, I've always thought, and it's probably not my quote by any means, but you know, we measure what's easy, not what's meaningful. So we love numbers, right? So 200 people were there, or we got our message out to X and Y, but we don't really get down to the stuff that actually matters. The relational stuff that actually is moving the needle, that is making a difference. But you've been at this for a heck of a long time.
I think, you know, and this is a crazy thing, but I think because it was 1988, I was in Africa, and I had a really good life. I had an amazing life. I had everything. And there was something within me that was really pushing me out of that life, and it was complicated, and other issues arose that I'm fully responsible for, but there was also this feeling inside me that I needed to be involved in something besides what I was doing,
right?
You know, as far as communications, and it was, in the book I describe it, but there were other dimensional elements too, which,
interesting,
you call it what you will and it doesn't matter, but it was as though that I was being told at some subliminal level that there was something I had to do, and I believe that all over the world there were people who were rising up at that time and being conscious, being aware, and shifting their gears. And I talk with lots of people who are involved in conscious media, for instance, and there was a kind of awakening back then amongst many of us. Marianne Williamson was really just beginning to speak out and write, and Deepak Chopra was awakened. And, you know, these are great leaders. I was just a little, journalist in Kenya, but I was waking up, and I realized the power of media. And then after Dan was killed, I really wanted to make a feature film that would wake people up around the belief that young people could be activated and play a role, you know, and that young journalists were literally dying to tell stories. And we actually made a film called Dying to Tell a Story with CNN and TBS that was one of the first films that charted what happens to journalists when they're exposed to such horror and why they keep doing it.
Right, almost that's a sense of that post-traumatic stress almost.
Yeah.
And how that actually plays out in a variety of ways. I was in Kenya in 1989. I spent 4 weeks in Eldoret. I was an electrician on strike at the time, helping to build the medical clinic. I was approached by a group of people, and about 20 of us went on this trip. And it would, to say that it changed my life, I met a guy by the name of Josh. When I speak publicly, I tell everybody about Josh and how he changed my life. And sadly, I have no photos of Josh, pre-digital, of course. But boy, to say that it turned my world upside down is an understatement.
Yeah, I recommend it for anybody who's feeling, blasé about life or curious about that there might be more. Kenya certainly did it for me, and it did it for you, and it does it for many, many people. But it doesn't have to be Kenya. But I think stretching ourselves,
yeah, the sense of waking up,
life begins beyond our comfort zone.
So it's great. That's a great line. But you know, I honestly, Kathy, I mean, you sound so positive, but I don't know if people actually believe that. Do you really think they do, that life does begin beyond our comfort zones?
I don't know what people believe. I know it's what I believe. I think we are phoning it in so much of the time. We are living almost in a dream. And it's not a bad dream necessarily,
right,
or it can be. It's just that we get in habits and I believe that if you chart, you know, they have ways to chart your cell phone movement, and it just tends to be kind of looping back and forth and in and out and over and under. You know, you're not really going very far beyond a particular path. And when you do explore, and Dan actually had a wonderful phrase, what's the difference between exploring and being lost? Or there is little difference between exploring and being lost.
Right.
The sense of getting beyond just what is right in front of you and you see every day, and we don't see it anymore. I mean, when you drove to town yesterday, do you recall seeing absolutely anything along the way? Or were you listening to the radio? Or, you know, we're in a waking dream so often. And I think travel is the solution. And when I say travel, I don't mean you have to go to Somalia or Kenya. You can go to an unexplored part of town and open your eyes and go to a restaurant that you would never, ever, ever think of going, you know, try it out. Try pig knuckles.
They're very tasty.
Somebody testicles. Yeah. Be a boat.
That's
try
right.
something different.
That's
right. Stop being boring.
So when Dan decides to become this explorer, if I can call him that, where does that put you? Do you feel sort of excited about the path that he's decided to take back at a very young age? And, you know, obviously went on to do great things in the film and so on, and his journals have impacted and affected so many. Where were you at the time? Wow, it's okay for other people's kids, but I'm not so sure about my own.
No, not really. My parents at 90 were still traveling. They went to, I think, probably 70 countries. And
wow.
Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. They were really, so they've been to more countries than I have.
There's a real thread here.
There's a thread. And I grew up in Iowa, you know.
Right.
It's like, I don't know what, the center of Canada, but I grew up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and it's a really wonderful town surrounded by cornfields. And at a very early age, I wanted to know what was beyond those cornfields.
Oh, yeah, I guess
so. And I
was
so lucky at 16. I was selected to go to South Africa as a foreign exchange student, American Field Service. And I was was the only one who was chosen to go to an Afrikaans school. And remember, it was 1963. It was a really long time ago. And apartheid was booming, and the riots in Soweto were happening, and it was a very, very tense time. And my parents, you know, sort of sat me down. I didn't even know where South Africa was. I'd applied
right.
to the Southern Hemisphere. I thought Guatemala, Mexico, you know, maybe, maybe Venezuela. I didn't know there was a place called South Africa. And my parents had to really think about whether they wanted me to go to this really dangerous place. But I was being sent to this tiny town in the middle of the Orange Free State, which was remarkably like Iowa. So I went, and little did we know that the family that I was staying with, the uncle, Bram Fischer, was actually the person who was defending Nelson Mandela in the Rivonia trials. So our house was watched and our phone was tapped, and it was extremely tense. And it was fascinating because I was going to school with the Boers, who were good people, but they had been brainwashed by the church to believe that black people were, you
right,
know,
right.
Not exactly, you know, people who should be treated as equals. So it was a really interesting time. And the irony now is that I work with Kwaku Mandela, whose grandfather, he is very aware of the role that Bram Fischer played in saving his grandfather's life.
Mm.
And it's just so beautiful that he and I get to work together.
Yeah, it's amazing. Wow. The connections you've made along the way, it's truly remarkable. You know, you talked about this, call it what you want. You said this need that you felt to be involved. And I think I saw a trailer for the film, or maybe it was off the creative the website, but talking about Dan and saying this was what he was made to do.
Absolutely.
Do you know where I'm going with this? Like that sense of being, you know, getting out of bed going, I can't do anything else. I can't do otherwise. I have to change the world. I have to get involved. I have to roll my sleeves up. That's fascinating to me.
Well, and thank you. And I think that came very much from his upbringing.
Right.
He was brought up, we moved to Nairobi, Kenya when Dan was 7 years old.
Mm.
He'd been, up until that time, I'd been locked away in the suburbs of England. Not, you know, because we wanted to be in the suburbs of England, but of London, excuse me. My husband was running a computer company, and he was British. And I ended up in this sweet little town, as frustrated as possible to be, because I'd gone to a college, actually Hillary Clinton's college, Wellesley College.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
It was a year behind me. And Hillary and I, and everybody went to Wellesley, were absolutely conditioned to engage in the world around us. And I was in the suburbs with two small children, and I was frustrated and really desperate to roll up sleeves and do something that mattered. And moving to Kenya was an explosion, a sort of technicolor dream for me, because most things hadn't been done already. You didn't have to have a PhD or even
right.
a master's degree. You know, you didn't necessarily have to get a license to do it. You just
did it.
A problem, you just did it. And I called them creative, active souls, you know, who are out there making things happen.
It's good.
And I got to tell stories. I talked my way into the newspaper and magazines and wrote books. And I got to interview the most amazing black, white, every possible shade of people. And Dan trailed along behind me and Amy, and it inspired, this experience of these people inspired Dan. And his best friend was Philip Leakey's daughter, Laura, Louis Leakey's granddaughter. Louis Leakey was the greatest paleontologist, you know, his son Richard is still...
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, Amy was off with Mary Leakey exploring Olduvai Gorge, you know, when she was four. Dan's best friend was a young man named Lengai Crows, and Lengai lived on the edge of the Nairobi Game Park. They were running after giraffes and playing with the Maasai warriors when he was 14, 13, 12, 10. You know, so for them, it was perfectly normal
right.
to ask to drive down to South Africa when he was 17 years old in a battered old Land Rover that he convinced his grandparents to help him buy in lieu of going to college right away. He wanted to take a year on, not a year off. But, you know, this was not
such a great phrase,
coming out
yeah.
of outer space, this desire to
right.
explore. It was because of the people.
Well, I'm always blown away. I'm always fascinated by people who do, capital D, and who do get involved. And I'm always really interested to know what was it. I mean, I'm not looking to land on some kind of formula. I teach at Humber right. College, you know, postgraduate students in international development, and I'm always interested to hear their stories. You know, why this and not so? Why aren't you an accountant? You know, why do you want to change the world? And so, you know, to say that it can't be otherwise, and that's how I feel, and I want everybody to feel the same way, right, Kathy? You know, come on board with me. You know, why don't you care about these things? Or maybe you do, and you just, you know, as you say, we're, you know, we've been captivated by this waking dream.
Oh, boy. I think a lot of it is about exposure and you know, what do we choose to take in?
Mm.
And again, without newspapers, if people are not reading newspapers, I know they're getting their news online, and that's great, but it tends to be we choose what we want to read often. So if we're on Facebook, you know, it tends to be people like us who are exposing us to something.
Right.
I actually still am such a junkie. We get two newspapers every day, the LA Times and the New York Times. I don't know how many magazines we get. But when you're constantly being exposed to challenges in the world around you, it does it increases empathy or it just shuts you down.
Or it shuts you down, right?
Yeah. It's so overwhelming that you just want to turn your face to the wall. But I think it can become addictive. And if we expose our children to current events and open up opportunities for them to explore and not be in their bubble. And I worry, you know, I live next door to my daughter and her husband's a big Hollywood director and, you know, they have the choice of remaining in a bubble. They could just go to their fancy private school and come home and ignore the world. But I know that's not going to happen because John is very conscious. Amy was brought up in Africa, you know,
right,
in London.
Right.
And there's no way in God's green earth that she is going to allow her children to remain in a bubble. And yet a lot of the kids around her, and it's not an indictment, it's not a judgment, it's just that happens. And then the designer handbags become very important, you know, oh my God. And
it's true. It's so true. How do you, there's so much noise.
There's so much noise. You're right. Oh my goodness. And right now in Aleppo, you know, what's happening in Aleppo is as bad as it gets, and what's happening right now in Haiti, you know, where they've literally flattened that much of that country again with a hurricane. And then what do we choose? What do we choose? What battles? I have right now 100 projects under our umbrella.
Wow.
Everything from climate change, you know, it's called an inconvenient use, to sex trafficking, to, you know, I can go on and on. And what do I choose? Where do I go?
Yep. Well, this is the excuse that I hear so often. You must hear it too, Kathy. Geez, you know, there's just so much. Where do I get involved? And I think to your point, I think it's, well, start by rolling up the sleeves. That's you've got a little bit of commitment there now. And now maybe research, you know, media, and then land somewhere and start to express, you know, maybe. Yeah.
Do you know that Teddy Roosevelt, he said, do what you can with what you have where you are.
Right.
And to be honest, that just kind of like disarms anyone because, okay.
Do you ever get the, and I get this from time to time, but do you ever get the classic, so why there and not here, Kathy? Why are you so worried about people everywhere else but here?
What about
those cornfields in Iowa? I mean, come on.
I really totally agree with you, and we increasingly are focusing our attention in that do what you can with what you have where you are. I never use the word change at the phrase change the world. It's always change the world around you.
Change the world around
think,
you. Yeah.
You know, it's almost easier to send money to Somalia than it is to head to Anaheim and see what's happening with sex trafficking and impoverished families in the motels there. Or just down the road, we have a homeless man on the other side of our wall. We have a number of them.
I just interviewed Hugh Gibson, and his film was at TIFF as well, The Stairs, it's called. You might have heard of it. And he followed the lives of three former crack addicts and one prostitute in Toronto. And essentially the reviews are, if you live in Toronto, you have to see this film because you haven't seen this part of Toronto, this side of Toronto. And it's time to become a part of this conversation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can't shove it off. And I think that becomes the rallying cry is just look around. And you know what? If it's the kid down the block who needs a mentor, an elder, or a helping hand, or if it's the old person up in the apartment building, you know, it doesn't matter. You do not have to tackle everything. You can tackle one person, one situation.
And Kathy, maybe in a compassionate and inclusive way. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, and maybe it sounds like I am, but
no.
That if you see that person down at the end of the street, to me that sort of presupposes a certain amount of empathy already and compassion to say, geez, I got to reach out somehow.
Well, and fearlessness, because
you
can recognize something. I was just the most amazing woman last week. I was in Hawaii with a woman named Scarlett Lewis. And Scarlett is, her little boy Jesse was killed in Sandy Hook, part of that.
Wow.
The massacre of small children by a tortured, mentally ill young man. And Scarlett's response, based on her son's chalking a message on their chalkboard, he's 6 years old, which was choose love. Scarlett created a movement, essentially, which is choose love. And her whole point is, you know, you have to be compassionate and empathetic, but you have to be fearless. You have to not just recognize that there's an issue. You have to go out there and do it. Her message is for first K through 12th graders, and it's called the Choose Love campaign, Jesse Lewis's Choose Love campaign. But it's just like, you know, compassion and empathy are absolutely critical. But then the next thing is, hey, you know what? You have to connect eye to eye with that person, and it may be a stranger. And sometimes it's just a recognition of another human being in the world. And I think you're probably familiar with the namaste, the greeting, the God in me salutes the God in you. It's like,
yes,
you know,
yes, yes.
But I love that, and just seeing someone.
Well, I love the word recognition. I mean, if you truly do recognize the other, if you truly do, I guess, validate them, whoever that happens to be, it seems to me that that's a step, it's the step that has to take you in the right direction.
Well, I loved what you just said, the recognition of the other. And in this world, I'm so sorry, but it is, you know, the tragedy of Trumpology is that everybody...
sorry, I'm Canadian. I'm allowed to laugh, right?
You're allowed to. Thank you very much. I hesitate to bring politics...
Oh, please do, Kathy. Please do. Yeah.
We are, fresh off watching every possible news broadcast.
Oh, I bet.
You know, the other. Who is the other?
Yeah.
And the other disabled black women. Everybody's the other and nobody's the other. You know, to somebody, we are the other. So get over it. Just stop it.
Yeah.
Get over it. And recognition that we're all the other, recognition that we are all in this together. And quite frankly, the challenges that we're facing in our world at this moment are only going to be solved if we come together as what I call a global tribe and handle it together.
Nice.
It just doesn't work any other way.
Global Tribe is great because that helps to sort of deal sort of with that question, why here and not there and vice versa. It's not, and again, it's to my earlier comment, it's not either or I don't, or at least I don't think it should be. It's got to be kind of comprehensive and inclusive and collaborative and all those things. But Trumpology cracks me up, by the way. And we're watching it quite carefully up here, too.
It's totally addictive. You know, it's the reality show of all time. It's just unbelievably addictive.
And
what are we going to do after the election?
That's right.
Totally boring.
Yeah, exactly. There's going to be nothing to do. What do you do, Kathy? I mean, I just, you know, I've spent some time over the last couple of days on your sites and looking at kind of the bigger picture that is you. How do you recharge? Like, do you collect, like, matchbooks or something?
Or,
what is it? You into bugs?
I'm into bugs. Oh, got a lot of bugs. You know what? I'm so lucky.
Yeah.
When you finally read this crazy book that I wrote, you'll find out. But years ago, Amy and I, my daughter, who's just, you know, my best friend in the world, we've done 7 films together, and we've written a bunch of books together. First book we did was a guided journal called Angel Catcher, which was getting through grief. You know, how do you do this?
Mm-hmm.
And it was for people to fill in. And then we did one called Soul Catcher, which was helping us find purpose in our lives. And then we kind of looked at each other, and we've been working really hard and made these films. And so we did a book called Love Catcher because we didn't have the right love in our lives. And I brought on I materialized this amazing character who kind of invented the design industry in the world and just an incredible man. And he was renting his house in, believe it or not, Malibu. You know, Amy and I were living in West Hollywood in not squalor, but we were living in small flats in Hollywood,
right.
Eating beans and rice, doing documentaries and writing books. And it was tough, man. So I met this amazing man. He was renting his other house in Malibu to a director named John Turteltaub, who was doing National Treasure at the time, directing. And Amy would come and visit us every weekend when I was visiting Michael. And she met John, and John and she fell in love, and Michael and I, and I married Michael, she married John, and now we live side by side in Malibu, you know, in these beautiful, really lucky, again, such luck. And we've created a center next door above American Apparel, this beautiful white building, where hundreds of people pass through, thousands of people pass through every year. And so I have the great joy of living next to Amy and 3 little kids. The youngest is a 2-year-old sort of mini-me, which is driving me bananas. She connects with everything, rock, stone, human beings. Hi! and I live, you know, next to my work. How can I ever, you know, I don't need, the recharge comes with lots,
right.
You know, with small children.
The recharge is built in.
It's built in.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah,
the recharge
fantastic.
Is going upstairs and talking. Today, I've got 5 meetings with people who are doing amazing things in the world.
Yeah,
and I get to tell them, hey, you keep doing it. It's going to be okay. You know,
yeah.
Don't give up.
Yeah.
And by the way, maybe you might want to consider meeting, blah, blah, blah. You know, what a treat.
Yeah, that's amazing.
How can I go wrong? The idea of not being able to do this sends me to despair.
Right.
I mean, that would be awful.
And just to come back, and let's get a couple plugs in here. We're going to have to wrap it up here in a couple minutes. The book, the crazy book you're talking about, is In the Heart of Life, yes?
Yeah. It's called In the Heart of Life, and it's an exploration of many themes, probably, you know, a number of themes. One is that there's another dimension that we can interact with, which, remember, I'm a PBS, you know, filmmaker. I'm a journalist. I'm a CNN. I'm all this stuff. But I believe there's another dimension that we can interact with. I really do. It's a book about love and passion and suffering. Passion means suffering as well as just love. Mm. And it was really hard to write it. And it reveals a lot about me, and not all of it is good at all.
I can't wait to read it. Honestly.
Thank you. I think you're too young. I don't think you should.
I think I'm too young.
Really, you may not want to interview me anymore.
That's right. That's right. It's gonna change everything. Yes. A dark cloud will descend over
cloud.
David's life. Yeah. I don't think so. I don't think
Forget
that's
it. Even... Here's the other one, The Journey is a Destination. That's Dan's book, and it's just amazing. It's,
right.
It's a collection of his journal pages, and it's the inspiration for the film.
Yeah, it's so great. Kathy, I hope we can do part two. In fact, I'm almost going to demand it.
I was going to say, I'm going to demand it, damn it. You're not getting away from me.
That's right. This has been way too short.
I have more things to ask you.
We got so much to talk about. It's fantastic. I don't even know where to send my listeners. So we're going to put a bio up. We're going to put some links for people. We'll send them to your website. That's folks, that's Kathy with a K, Kathy Eldon, Eldon.com. Look up the film. The Journey is the Destination, still quite live on TIFF.net's site. The Journey is the Destination by Bronwyn Hughes. And we're hoping maybe I'm going to be able to do an interview with her. And then, holy smokes, if that's not enough, we've got creativevisions.org. And it just, I'm astounded by what you're up to, Kathy. It's amazing.
Thank you. Don't forget daneldon.org.
Right, of course. I'm sorry.
He's pretty noisy. I call him a noisy soul, noisy spirit.
Well, and there's such a great, and on creative, I think it's on creativevisions.org, there's a really great, what is it, 4 or 5 minute film clip that everybody needs to see about Dan and his life, and it's a really nice way in. So I'll definitely direct people there, too. Wow, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Love it, David, and I look forward to hearing your conversations with far more interesting people than me. So and thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. And listen, I think we need to get a t-shirt. Life begins beyond our comfort zones, if that doesn't already exist.
I don't know if it does, but I think I'm going to go.
We got to do something about that, Kathy. Yeah.
I love it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.